This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We had expected to feature our interview with Mira Bartok today about having a mother who was paranoid, schizophrenic, violent, and for many years homeless. We're going to postpone that interview until tomorrow because we want to talk about Saturday's horrifying shootings in Tucson. Jared Loughner, the man charged with the shooting, appears to be mentally ill. His bizarre and disruptive behavior got him suspended from community college. When he tried to enlist in the Army, he was rejected after failing a drug test. Yet in Tucson, he was able to legally buy a semi-automatic weapon and carry it without a permit. That made it possible for him to shoot Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords in the head, kill six people, including federal judge John Roll and a 9-year-old student council president, and wound 19 others. My guest, James Grimaldi, is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter with The Washington Post. He's contributed to their series, The Hidden Life of Guns. We talked with him about that series last week. We invited him back today to talk about Arizona's lenient gun laws, which he reported on yesterday in The Post. James Grimaldi, welcome back to Fresh Air. I'm sorry I have to talk to you again under these circumstances.
Thanks for inviting me.
So Arizona is one of the states with the most lenient gun laws. Would you describe those laws?
Well, essentially, there is very little obstacle to purchasing a weapon in the state of Arizona. There are laws that require you federally to be at least 21 years old to purchase a handgun. But basically, state law permits anyone 21 or older to own a firearm and also carry it concealed in the state. And that's different than other states, which many of which have more strict gun laws.
In 2010, Governor Jan Brewer signed a bill that repealed a state law that required gun owners to have a permit to carry a concealed weapon. So now to carry a concealed weapon, you no longer need a permit in the state of Arizona.
Right. And in fact, that's a law in various forms the previous governor, Janet Napolitano, had vetoed. It was obviously somewhat contentious, but when Brewer came in, being a Republican and being a strong supporter of the Second Amendment, she repealed that law.
Do you know if Loughner's weapon is considered to have been a concealed weapon?
No, I'm unaware of the exact location of the weapon. I think most of the eyewitnesses didn't notice the weapon until he was firing it.
If Loughner was carrying his weapon as a concealed weapon, what does that mean in terms of if he could have been, frisked by a cop? Now, there weren't cops on the scene. There wasn't security on the scene. But say there was. With the law being as it is now in Arizona, would that have made him suspicious and given a policeman grounds to frisk him or question him?
Right. Well, the current law says you're permitted to carry a weapon concealed in the state of Arizona. So a law enforcement officer would probably have to find some other reason to stop him and search him. So because of that change in the law, he's unlikely to have been stopped for having a concealed weapon.
So now in Arizona, you can carry a concealed weapon without a permit. Say it was 2009 in Arizona and you needed a permit to carry a concealed weapon. Would that have made a difference possibly in Loughner's ability to be at that event with a concealed weapon?
Well, prior to the passage of the law, if a law enforcement officer saw someone carrying a concealed weapon or, say, saw a bulge under a jacket, that law enforcement officer could stop the person, ask for a permit, ask if they were carrying a concealed weapon, and then if they didn't have a permit for a concealed weapon, they could search them. Perhaps something might have stopped Loughner before getting there if there had been some circumstance like that prior to the shooting.
Now, you report that Loughner passed an instant background check at Sportsman's Warehouse in Arizona where he purchased his Glock. This was on November 30th. What is an instant background check in the state of Arizona?
Well, under the Brady Law, which was passed in 1994 and named for Jim Brady, the press secretary for Ronald Reagan, who was injured in that assassination attempt. The Brady Law requires a national instant check system. Back in the 90s, that took several days, but over the years, they've made that essentially a check that, depending on state to state, they make a phone call to see if the person ends up being a prohibited buyer in the system. The main thing they look for are felony convictions, because you can't be a felon and purchase a firearm, certainly can't purchase a handgun under the federal law. You need to be also, for a handgun, 21 years old. They also look for mental health records, and there's been some attempts by many states to improve the reporting of those mental health records, particularly in Virginia, for example, after the Virginia Tech shooting.
So it seems pretty clear that Loeffner is mentally ill, but he passed the instant background check. Do you know what it takes to have mental illness come up in a background check?
Well, I think it would certainly require, at the very least, some sort of diagnosis of Mr. Loeffner. I don't know that there's an indication that he'd actually seen a mental health professional who would be able to report such information to the authorities. And as it is now, many prohibited persons are not blocked from buying guns because the records aren't in NICS, including about 80 to 90% of disqualifying mental health records, according to the Brady Campaign, which is a gun control organization.
In other words, you might have a mental health record, but if it isn't in the instant background check database, it won't come up. So
essentially,
you'll still be able to buy the weapon.
That's correct.
Now, it's been reported that Loeffner tried to buy ammunition at a Walmart in Arizona, and because of his behavior, he was turned down. But he went to another Walmart where he successfully made the ammunition purchase. Is there any discretion required of gun or ammo sellers?
Well, yes. There's essentially, there are very little limitations on ammunition and purchasing ammunition. But gun stores exercise a lot of discretion. And as we talked about last week, they often consider themselves the first line of defense in trying to prevent what would be seen as an illegal purchase. When you buy a weapon, for example, you have to fill out a Form 4473, and on there you have to say that you haven't been convicted or not an abuser of drugs or alcohol. We know that Mr. Loeffner had apparently an arrest that was dismissed regarding drug paraphernalia. There's some people who believe that perhaps there should have been some reporting to the NICS system about that kind of arrest. But I know of gun dealers, and we've interviewed some gun dealers who say that they simply will refuse a sale if they believe the person is lying on that form.
Now, the Glock firearm that he did purchase, it's considered a semi-automatic pistol?
That's right.
And my understanding is that gun would have been outlawed. You wouldn't have been able to manufacture or sell it if the automatic weapon bill that expired in 2004 was still in effect. This was a bill that was passed during the Clinton administration.
I'm not an expert about what would fall into or not fall into the assault weapons ban. I do know that many organizations, especially pro-gun groups, say part of the problem with that law is, how do you define an assault weapon? How do you define what falls into that category? We talked last week about this bill that would prohibit multiple purchases of assault weapons along the border in relation to the Mexico gun trade. And they've come up with a definition for that seems rather narrow. But I can tell you, definitions of what does and does not fall under the assault weapon ban is highly controversial. And many gun advocates essentially mocked that law from the 90s, saying that it was easily circumvented.
One of the things that makes Arizona gun laws so relatively lenient is that Arizona allows guns in places that many states do not. What are some examples?
Well, guns are permitted almost everywhere in the state except a business or doctor's office. The State Rifle Association even lists on its website restaurants that permit concealed weapons. Guns are permissible inside the state capitol and many other public buildings. We know under the Supreme Court's recent rulings that states are permitted to ban weapons in schools, churches, public buildings. But Arizona, and it's my understanding Texas as well, allows them on the Capitol grounds. And I think a lot of this has to do with Arizona's stand on gun ownership, which is rooted in the Constitution of the state.
So in Arizona, it's legal to carry a concealed weapon without a permit. What about a non-concealed weapon?
That's fine. In fact, you probably could see people with holsters. I think if it's out in the open, it's not considered concealed and they could carry it. But that also might prompt a law enforcement officer to ask about it. Regardless, it's legal.
What would they have the right to ask?
Well, maybe they wouldn't have a right to stop them. That's a good question. I mean, I don't think it's uncommon to find people carrying weapons unconcealed in the state of Arizona.
So
it's not like every restaurant that you go to, but there certainly are groups who like to promote this. They think it's a good thing.
After the Virginia Tech shootings, there was a bill that was introduced to allow students and teachers to carry guns into the school. And I assume that means college because you have to be 18
right.
to own a gun. So am I right in saying that would be college as opposed to high school?
Right, or junior college, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. So what's the status of that proposal?
Well, I think it's still pending. A former state senator, Pamela Gorman, told us, she was a sponsor of the bill, that the people who would you'd be trying to control from bringing in those guns will probably not pay attention to the law. And if they're thinking about killing someone, the fact that the gun isn't registered or is not permitted on those grounds wouldn't stop them. So the feeling is, why shouldn't law-abiding citizens have them to defend themselves against people like that?
The Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, she owned a gun. She was a supporter of Second Amendment rights when the Supreme Court struck down Washington, D.C.'s ban on handgun ownership as unconstitutional. She released a statement saying, as a gun owner, I am a strong supporter of the Second Amendment. Yet at the same time, the NRA spent money trying to defeat her and gave her a D rating. So what was that based on? I mean, she supported the rights of gun owners.
Well, I've spent a lot of time looking at the NRA ratings, and unfortunately, they're not as transparent as I would like them to be. There are probably a couple of reasons. One, if she supported any limitation on guns whatsoever, that's likely to bump her down at least a grade. And after a couple of those, they could be bumping her down precipitously. Also, last year, you'll recall, in the last Congress, there was a campaign finance bill that the National Rifle Association opposed, and there were some votes to exempt them from being covered by the new campaign finance law. And I don't know that that bill was rated, but I have a hunch that maybe that's one of the reasons she got knocked down to a D. Plus, the NRA thought they had found a stronger candidate and a stronger supporter of gun rights in a Marine Sergeant Jesse Kelly, age 29, so much so that they spent about $40,000 in the race to defeat Giffords and to support Kelly.
It's interesting that I think both sides on the gun control issue are using Saturday shootings to justify the positions. Gun control advocates are saying we need stricter laws. But on the other hand, for instance, Congressman Jason Chaffetz of Utah, he's a Republican, and Heath Shuler of North Carolina, who's a Democrat, told Politico that they'll be carrying their guns in their home districts for protection, and they have conceal and carry permits.
It doesn't surprise me, actually, because the gun issue is so divisive in this country. And we've talked to both sides of the issue, and both sides are going to see this incident from their own point of view. Gun owners and supporters of the Second Amendment and supporters of, you know, everyone having guns, or at least legal people having guns, feel like, well, maybe if they had, they might have been able to stop it sooner than they had. And then supporters of reasonable limits on gun ownership and limits on the use of guns feel like some of those laws might have prevented him from either buying or carrying the weapon to that scene. And I don't think even a show like this could ever resolve that difference.
Is there any gun legislation before Congress now?
Well, the Congress is so new. I don't know if any bills have been introduced, but I do know we're expected to see the reintroduction of the ATF Modernization Act, and that's regarding the federal agency, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. And there's an attempt by supporters of the NRA, and it's an NRA-backed bill that would make it harder to close a gun store. The NRA and the gun store owners believe they often get shut down for paperwork violations. Many in the ATF, and I think the ATF formally, opposes parts of this rule because it would make it so much more difficult for the ATF to close down a store that might be a bad actor or a rogue dealer.
I know the story that you're researching now for publication tomorrow in the Washington Post has to do with how restrictions apply to people who are mentally ill and trying to purchase a gun. Do you see that as one of the really important questions emerging from the shootings on Saturday?
Well, yeah, I think so. Everyone would agree this man should not have had a gun. And there's a question about whether the National Instant Check System was thorough enough to include him. Was there something that should have been in there? Should it have he have come up because he had been diagnosed with a mental illness? Should there have been some restriction because he had an arrest for drug paraphernalia, even though it was dismissed? Was there some other thing that could have been in the system? I know after Virginia Tech, the state of Virginia tried to tighten the reporting requirements for mental illness because clearly the man involved in that incident was mentally ill. And the question probably is out there today, you know, should there be more restrictions in this NICS database, as it's called? But I think you'll also still see some resistance from some people because there are even questions about veterans. Some veterans may have had a mental illness. It may be okay now and believe that they ought to be permitted to carry a weapon. And there is a little bit of pushback, maybe even a lot of pushback from the Second Amendment folks who believe that some people may end up in that database who shouldn't be in the database.
You and I recently spoke about your investigation into how guns sold in the United States end up in the hands of the Mexican drug cartels. It's relatively easy to buy a gun in Arizona. Are there a lot of guns from Arizona that are ending up in Mexico?
Yes. Arizona is the second most frequent state to have guns from Mexican crime scenes traced back to the United States. And one of the top 12 gun stores in the country is in Arizona. It's called Lone Wolf. And the ATF is keeping an eye on that. They've busted up a number of gun smuggling schemes out of the state of Arizona in the past several years. These are schemes that purchase guns that go straight down into Mexico. And in fact, one of their only prosecutions of a case of a dealer that was involved, they believed, knowingly in gun running to Mexico was prosecuted in Phoenix. In that case, the store owner was basically acquitted when the judge dismissed the case before it was finished being heard.
Why did he dismiss the case?
The judge felt that the ATF had not produced enough evidence to prove the case, and they felt that they had not been able to trace the guns directly down into Mexico back to the store, and that the sale that the gun store was making was essentially a misdemeanor case, and he dismissed it.
Well, James Grimaldi, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
James Grimaldi is an investigative reporter with The Washington Post. He contributed to their series, The Hidden Life of Guns, and yesterday wrote about Arizona's lenient gun laws. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Chances are that you have hundreds, maybe thousands of emails stored on your remote servers or in your computer. You might have a Facebook page or a MySpace or Twitter account, and you might have countless photos in a Flickr album. All that stuff amounts to a digital profile of sorts, which raises an interesting question. What happens to that material when we die? Do our families get access to our email, precious photos, or financial data? Are there some things we'd prefer that nobody see? Our next guests, Evan Carroll and John Romano, are two technology experts who focused for the past couple of years on this very issue. They founded an online resource called thedigitalbeyond.com, and they've written a new book with practical advice called Your Digital Afterlife. They spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, John Romano and Evan Carroll, welcome to Fresh Air. Our digital assets or our identity or whatever we want to call it exists partly in computers that we own in our homes, but much of it exists in servers elsewhere, right? I mean, email services, Facebook, MySpace. Do these online service providers have a procedure for handling the death of a subscriber?
Some of these services do have particular procedures. Some of you may have Twitter accounts, and upon request with the appropriate documentation, Twitter will share an archive of your public tweets with a next of kin, and then disable your account if they so choose. But some service providers take a more harsh stance and say that in order to protect the privacy of the deceased, that they won't provide access to anyone, no matter what kind of documentation they may have. If I may go into a story here, in 2004, U.S. Marine Justin Ellsworth was killed in action, and he left behind a Yahoo email account. And his father, John Ellsworth, wanted to make a scrapbook of the many supportive emails that his son had received during his time in service. Unfortunately, Yahoo's terms of service actually prevented him from gaining access to that information. So later he actually filed in court to have an order placed for Yahoo to provide that information, and he was actually successful. But in Yahoo's terms of service, it does say that your accounts are non-transferable and have no right of survivorship.
To further that, there's also no standardization right now. And this is kind of against the interests of all the users out there. There's no one way that all these service providers act. So Yahoo has their policy, Facebook has their policy, Twitter has another policy, and none of the policies are the same, which makes it really confusing for the average person to try to figure all this out.
So in the book, you give us some instructions, and you say that one thing that we should do is to name a digital executor, roughly akin to the executor of our will. Is a digital executor, is that a power that's recognized in law? How do you do that?
So a digital executor, unless you name them as a sort of a co-executor of your estate, they don't necessarily have full legal authority. But the reason we use this terminology is because it's very possible that the person who's handling your estate, say for instance it's a spouse, may not be the person who has the technical understanding to take care of your digital things. And we think there needs to be an important distinction there. Oklahoma passed a law which gives the executor of an estate legal authority to access digital accounts belonging to the decedent. And this, we're still waiting on some of our contacts in the legal profession to provide us some clarification on this, but this could provide some new groundwork for legal recognition of this role.
So if I'm hearing you right, that would mean the executor of your estate is, in effect, also the digital executor?
In the way we talk about it, yes, that would be so. But I could see situations where you may want to provide in your wishes that you tell your executor, you have the legal authority to do this, but I would like for you to make sure that this individual does these other things for me because they may be more suited for that task.
Right. Now, you suggest that we take an inventory of our data and then provide some specific instructions on what the digital executor should do with that data in the event that we die. Give us an example of what would be in this inventory and some of the kinds of options in terms of instructions.
I think when someone starts their inventory, one of the things they need to remember is that it doesn't have to be absolutely 100% exhaustive. I think what people need to concentrate on is the most important things in their life. Online, if you're using Flickr, let's say, to hold all your photographs and all those photographs are very important to you, make sure that that is going to be part of your inventory. I think people might get lost or bogged down or realize, oh my goodness, if I have to put every single online account, I'll be here till tomorrow writing them all down. But you can start simply by just taking those most important things to you, those things that you wouldn't want lost or things that you wouldn't want to be forgotten or disregarded, and put them in your inventory first. But your inventory really is just a list. It's a simple list that has, you know, the name of the object. This is my Flickr account, and it has ways to access that account. So it has your username and your password, and it has your wishes for it. What do you want to happen to that asset after you're gone? So if it's your Flickr account, you want to say, hey, I'd like this account to be given to my child or, you know, my loved one, then specify that in your wishes.
But you should be careful because Flickr is indeed owned by Yahoo, and the contents of your Yahoo account is, quote, non-transferable. So you may want to take steps to download the content of that account and make sure that you can legally pass that content to your son, for instance.
Right. I mean, strangely enough, actually passing it on to somebody potentially could be a breach of your terms of service in and of itself, just trying to give somebody else that password so they might have legal rights to delete it just by doing that. It gets a little bit tricky. But at this point, providing that access is so much better than the risk of not providing that access at all and having that potentially go away altogether.
Right. Well, now this raises an interesting situation here. I mean, suppose what's at issue is data like photos that are on an account that is non-transferable. If you instruct your surviving spouse or child to, in effect, violate the terms of service and download the stuff so they have access to it, is that something you'd recommend?
You know, I never want to recommend that someone violates a contract that they have executed, and I will say that I'm not an attorney, nor can I provide that advice. However, it's worth saying that as it stands right now, this is the only means by which you can provide access to those accounts. Now, with the Flickr example, it's worth saying that many Flickr photographs are sort of public information and that they can, you know, any Flickr user can go view them. And for those accounts, it might be easy to download those. But there are cases where some Flickr photos are private, and those may be the ones you want to share. The lawyers we worked with in reviewing our book have recommended that they feel accessing this information with your permission is, as far as legal structures go, akin to having an executor execute on your wishes. So they believe it's sort of in the spirit of the law by doing that. So it's definitely something worth considering, but at this stage, that's probably your best option.
This unfortunately exposes a little bit of a deeper issue as well. I mean, the issue is that there's no standardization across the industry, and there's no consistent means for people to handle this issue. So in the vacuum of a way that consumers can understand, consumers are going to try to figure out a way to solve their problem, which is they want this stuff to be passed to their children or somebody, and they're going to figure out a way to do that.
So you would recommend, again, if one develops a kind of a digital inventory of their stuff that they want to leave some instructions about, you'd want to include the email accounts and Flickr accounts where there might be photos and other things. I assume that this inventory would also include usernames and passwords, right?
That's correct. And it's important to consider that once you've created this inventory, that you should really consider how you're going to secure that inventory. Because the purpose of having a password in the first place is to keep things private. And if your inventory is too accessible, perhaps to people you don't want it to be accessible to, that can compromise the security of your accounts.
Right. And you certainly don't want to put them in your actual will.
Oh, certainly not, because a will, in effect, becomes public record. And if, say, for instance, there's your password sitting in the will, and if no one has changed that password since it was was put there, then your password is suddenly exposed to a greater audience. There are some interesting services that allow you to store your usernames and passwords in a secure service, like a secure server. And then you can include instructions in your will to go activate that service and release those passwords. Like one particular service, it works out of Switzerland, and they have an online data safe. They're actually called Data Inherit, and they actually include a 64-character code that you can place in with your will and with other documents. That you go to their website, you put in that 64-character code, and then it sends your passwords to the individual that you have authorized previously.
There are a number of companies that offer digital inheritance services. What do they do? What are some of the services that they offer?
Dave, there's a basic model for these services that they provide what we call storage, and that's a place to store your usernames and passwords, sort of an inventory of your accounts like we talked about earlier. And then they often provide some sort of trigger mechanism, and this is how they verify that you've passed away or become incapacitated and know to take action and deliver them to the individuals whom you specify, the recipients, the heirs that you want to have access to those accounts. There are a lot of different trigger options for these accounts. For instance, some services, I'll name a few, like Legacy Locker or Entrusted, actually require that your survivors provide a death certificate to their office that they can then verify and then open your account. Others require a secure passcode be entered that you might keep with your will. Others that are perhaps a bit less secure rely upon a group of verifiers, or say you might specify 10 people, and when 7 of them say, yes, you know, John has passed away, they'll go ahead and release that information.
I think one of the things that you need to be thinking about also is this is a lot of work to do to set up, and some of these services actually try to provide you some value during your life, not just trying to make it easier for your heirs. There's a service called Data Inherit that actually has a way of securing and recalling your own passwords throughout your own life. So every time you create a new account, you put the username and password in there real fast. And then in the event that your computer burns down or, you know, your list gets lost or something happens, you have the ability to recall all those usernames and passwords so you don't have to go back and struggle with it yourself.
You also write about a company, I think it's called digitalestateservices.com, that will get you into locked computers of your loved ones who may have passed away and uncover usernames and passwords.
Yes, Dave. So Digital Estate Services was a company that we actually located very late during the process of writing the book, sort of towards the end, and we added it in because they were taking a different view. So if you have someone who's passed away and you can, you might want to contact them afterwards and ask for their services to help you gain access. And they can do things like look for saved passwords in computers and different steps like that to try and get into these accounts. It is worth saying that you should respect that perhaps it wasn't a matter of failed planning on the part of the deceased, but perhaps they wanted to keep some things private. And in those situations where you're sort of retroactively trying to gain access to these things, I would recommend out of respect for the deceased that you are very careful in what you choose to do.
It's like a digital locksmith, right?
Right.
Digital locksmith, that's a great title for it.
There are also services that will deliver a posthumous online message to folks. How does that work?
There's a whole class of services we call posthumous email that will actually allow you to, before you die, go in and craft emails to your loved ones or to anybody you really want, and they would be sent out after this sort of trigger mechanism goes off and be sent out to all the people in your distribution list or whoever you want to get them. This would effectively allow you to, you know, either get the last word in on somebody or tell people how much you love them. I think there's so much grief at the end of the process and people start blaming themselves and there's a lot of guilt, and I think posthumous letters are a nice way to say, you know, don't worry about the last thing you said to me. You know, you've provided me a lot of joy in my life or whatever it is. And I think these posthumous email services have a really interesting way to do that. And a lot of them are now actually allowing you to attach video and audio clips to it, so you can actually get a video from these people once they're gone.
And I guess that there are sometimes you would just as soon see an account deleted. And I noticed that one company has a feature called Account Incinerator.
That's right. Obviously, there are accounts that people create during their life that they don't want handed down to their children or their spouse, and they want to be permanently gone. And there's a company called Entrustit, and they've actually, as part of their service, you can set up certain accounts that will automatically be deleted once you've passed away.
You know, we've been talking a lot about pictures, emails, and other kinds of content. You know, more and more people have financial information that they have online access to, and there are usernames and passwords that could be really valuable. Do you include that kind of information in your digital inventory and your instructions as well?
So it's our recommendation that you, of course, realize that anything that has sort of a financial matter should be executed according to your legal will, as we like to call it, to provide a differentiation between your digital estate planning. That said, there are a lot of accounts that allow you to both spend money and make money online that only exist online. And I would recommend that you take steps to and store those passwords so that your executor has access to them. Let's say, for instance, you might run an online business and need to provide your business partner or even your spouse, who might technically inherit that business, with that information. Or accounts like PayPal are really interesting, because many of us have our PayPal accounts linked to our checking accounts, and it's very easy to transfer money out of those accounts. So it's worth, as we like to say, looking at it systematically and thinking about, well, if so-and-so has access to this, then they might also have access to this, and really thinking about worst-case scenario of what could happen, and sort of safeguarding yourself against that.
There's also a lot of practical matters that we really need to think about, such as online bill paying and mortgage payment. I mean, if you have one person in your family that's doing all the paying bills, which I know a lot of families do, if that person passes away, the person left could be sitting there going, how do I pay my mortgage? How do I keep my lights on? So all those things are really important to pass on. Another sort of related issue to what Evan said with PayPal is, again, if you have to remember that email that you have is a key to all of these financial accounts often as well. So potentially an heir, or maybe even a person that you didn't want to be part of your estate, if they can get access to your email, they can reset your PayPal password, then that could basically give somebody who's unauthorized access to your checking account. So again, there are a lot of sort of interconnected issues that we kind of have to think about as we move forward.
You know, as I read the book, I became convinced that there's value to taking digital inheritance seriously. But I also realized that I'm not going to do a lot of this stuff. Just, you know, kind of day-to-day, I'm just never going to get to a lot of it. What are the simple things that somebody can do that are important? I mean, if one were to sort of break it down to the most minimal effort, what would you recommend?
I think I would immediately just say, figure out who you'd want to have your data. Or, you know, figure out who you would want to have access to that, and just have a conversation with them. I mean, a 5-minute conversation and say, listen, just so you know, I put my passwords here, and this is how I store them. And I've got a Flickr account and a, you know, the Vimeo account that I really care about. Just make sure you take care of those. I mean, that's a 2-minute conversation that you can have with someone that can make them aware of what to do after you're gone.
Evan, Carol, John Romano, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Evan Carroll and John Romano spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Carroll and Romano have written a new book called Your Digital Afterlife. Coming up, Maureen Carrigan reviews William Trevor's latest collection of short stories. This is Fresh Air. William Trevor has been writing for over 50 years, and during that time, he's won more literary awards than we have time to list here. Trevor has published 14 novels, but he's even more celebrated for his short fiction. Book critic Maureen Carrigan has a review of his latest collection of stories.
At the risk of sounding like an old geezer, prematurely, I might add, I think that the idea of curling up on a large piece of upholstered furniture with my fur ball of a dog nestled beside me and a good story to read sounds like the ideal winter endurance strategy. If you're the seriously dormant type too, I've got a book to recommend that packs so many good stories into one volume that if the demands of everyday life permit, you could stay safely socked away in your reading burrow till the first thaw. The book is the recently published second volume of William Trevor's collected stories. The writer, anointed by The New Yorker as the greatest living writer of short stories in the English language, and anointed by me as the hibernating bookworm's best friend. Trevor is a master of capturing those small shifts in consciousness that shatter someone's world. Because he's an Irishman living in exile, Trevor has lived most of his long life in England. And because so many of those aforementioned epiphanies take place oh so discreetly, the comparisons to James Joyce have been inevitable. But as the 48 recent stories in this volume attest, Trevor has a more developed taste for the macabre than Joyce ever did. It creeps up on a reader slowly, the awareness that so many of these tales are about being trapped, buried alive, thwarted at every turn of life's labyrinth. And yet, the signature response of Trevor's characters to their bricked-in situation is a fatalistic shrug, garnished with black Irish humor. The lead-off tale here is called The Piano Tuner's Wives, and the tidy first paragraph supplies the plot in miniature. Violet married the piano tuner when he was a young man. Belle married him when he was old. Belle, the 59-year-old second wife, was once the town beauty, smart in her clothes, who decades before was cast over by the piano tuner for her rival, Violet. Now Violet is in her grave, and Belle is in the marriage bed, and yet Violet still haunts their lives. Because the piano tuner is blind, he'd relied for decades on his first wife to be his eyes, so Belle literally hears her dead predecessor speaking through her husband's descriptions of the physical world. In the brilliant climax of the tale, Belle vindictively decides that if she can't banish her predecessor, she'll just banish the world Violet once inhabited. The Piano Tuner's Wives, like most of Trevor's stories, takes place in an Ireland that seems out of time. Most of Trevor's characters would have been right at home in the Ireland of the Celtic twilight, rather than the twilight of the Celtic tiger. In The Hill Bachelors, for instance, a young man named Pauly leaves his job in England to attend his father's funeral in rural Ireland. Silently, Pauly's four adult siblings conspire to appoint him the sacrificial lamb who'll stay on to help his aged mother run the isolated farm. The farming life Pauly passively agrees to could have been led by a character out of John Ford's 1950s classic about 1930s Ireland, The Quiet Man. In a spectacularly affecting story called After Rain, a young Irish woman named Harriet returns to an out-of-the-way Italian hotel that she'd stayed in as a child with her parents. Harriet is disappointed that the hotel is now overrun with tourists from the New Europe. She'd hoped to find refuge in the familiar, especially since a long-term romance has just fallen apart. In this turning point moment, which displays Trevor's eloquent precision, Harriet comes to realize the tragic trap of trying to recapture the past. This love affair had once, like the other affairs before it, felt like the exorcism of the disappointment that so drearily colored her life when her parents went their separate ways. Both parents said the separation was a happier outcome than staying together for the sake of the family. Her brother shrugged the disappointment off, but for Harriet, it did not begin to go away until the first of her love affairs. And always, when a love affair ended, there had been no exorcism after all. Trevor's outcasts never make obvious bids for our sympathy, but they elicit it nonetheless. The stories collected here also compose a quietly devastating argument for the beauty and power of the short story form as a tool for cutting to the quick of human desire and vulnerability.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed William Trevor's latest collection of short fiction called Selected Stories. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. ¶¶ Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. I'm Terry Gross.